name is Rebecca. I grew up in Batavia, Ohio, which is near Cincinnati. Whenever someone asks me where I'm from, I'll always just say Cincinnati. No one's going to be able to find Batavia on a map. It's a very small community. I love it. I mean, it's been my only home. I now work in the community. I work for Children's Services for Claremont County, which is a job that I've had for about a year and a half.
It's January 16th, 2020, and I'm talking to Rebecca Moore on Skype audio. Rebecca's describing for me her hometown of Batavia, Ohio, as well as her upbringing.
But growing up was a little different. My parents got divorced when I was 6 months old. So I just never knew what it was like to really have married parents, which was really fine for me because I didn't know the difference. But also my parents co-parented really well. Like they should have been like the poster child for like divorced parents. And it was just great. My mom was more of a like strict Monday through Friday, made sure I had all my basic needs met, just kind of mom. And then my dad was like my fun weekend dad. He worked as a cop, so his schedule was really weird. So whenever I was with my dad, I was actually at my grandparents. And so my grandparents had a really big role of just raising me. I was with them almost every weekend, which is just something that I love to look back on now. But yeah, our family was just pretty simple, especially for the first part of my life. And we just had a routine and there weren't really any big issues.
When recalling what it was like for her growing up, Rebecca speaks fondly of both of her parents, Sonia and Michael. Her mom was her rock, and her dad was a phenomenal father to her, a man who truly doted on his daughter. He was a Warren County Sheriff's deputy, and although he worked a lot, he always made time for her.
We just had a lot of fun. Like the place at his condo in Mason, there was a gas station about a mile away, and so we used to go and take his truck and go sit on the bed of the truck and eat ice cream together. That was something that we did almost weekly. And just like small little memories like that where I'm like, no, like my dad like really tried to make sure I had everything I could and treated me as if I was an adult and not just like a child that couldn't understand things. He always tried to explain things and tried to give life lessons from as early as I can remember.
Rebecca was an only child, although she would inherit some step-siblings a little later in life. After her parents' divorce when she was really young, her dad remarried twice, once when she was about 5 or 6, and then again a few years later. Her mom would remarry too, but not until she was 13. It was actually that year, when she was 13 years old, and just 2 months after her mom had gotten remarried to her now stepdad, when everything in Rebecca's world would change. It was the summer of 2009. She was with her youth group for church, and they had gone up to Cedar Point for an overnight trip. On their way back, in the 12-passenger church van, her youth pastor suddenly instructed them all to turn over their cell phones. He then turned off the radio and told them to just talk amongst themselves for the rest of the trip.
And so we get back to the church and all of the parents are like huddled together and I see my mom just sobbing and I was like, oh no. Because my mom's dad has been sick my whole life. And so I just automatically assumed that something had happened to my grandpa. And so they said, Rebecca, everyone needs to stay in. And I was like, cause I was like, my mom is crying. I said, I want to get out of this van. They're like, stay in here for a second. We'll come and get you. So my youth pastor went and talked to my mom for a few minutes and they came and got me. We walked into the church and I mean, I think it really explains my mom. She just sat me down and said, Rebecca, last night, your grandparents were murdered and your dad was shot in a burglary.
Rebecca had just received the worst news of her life. Her grandparents, Warren and Madge Moore, had been murdered and her dad had been shot in a burglary. As she tried to process what her mom was telling her, she had so many questions. What had happened? Where was her father? And would he be okay? This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 99. Last night, I ordered food from my favorite restaurant just by talking into a speaker in my living room. We are living in some pretty amazing times. But one thing remains the same, the way in which we color our hair. Here are your options. You can go to a salon, sit there for hours, and spend lots of money, or you can get a box kit at your local convenience store. The problem with that last option is that you either don't get the right color, or the color itself tends to dry out your hair. But now there's a new way, Madison Reed. It took a strong woman to shake up the hair coloring world, and Amy Arrett did just that with Madison Reed, the company she named after her daughter. Now you might be thinking, that all sounds great, but how do I match my color? Well, Madison Reed has you covered. They give you the tools you need so you can color with confidence. Get ammonia-free multi-tonal hair color delivered right to your door for less than $25. Visit madison-reed.com. That's madison-reed.com. And now, Court Junkies can get 10% off plus free shipping on your first color kit. Use code COURTJUNKIE. That's madison-reed.com, code COURTJUNKIE. If you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. That is what NetSuite by Oracle has set out to solve. Because most companies don't have a clear picture of their finances, and that's why many businesses fail. The question for any business owner out there is, are you confident that you've got the right numbers at your fingertips? Much like how you wouldn't fly an airplane blind, you shouldn't be oblivious about your business either. Serious entrepreneurs and finance teams run on NetSuite by Oracle, the world's number one cloud business system. NetSuite offers a full picture of all of your finances, all in one place, in real time, right from your phone or your desktop. No more guessing. No more worry that what you don't know could kill your company. That's why NetSuite customers grow 3 times faster than the S&P 500, and you can too. Schedule your free demo right now and receive their free guide, 7 Key Strategies to Grow Your Profits, at netsuite.com/court. Set up your free demo and get your free guide today at netsuite.com/court. netsuite.com/court. And so what are some of your favorite childhood memories? So I know you were talking about going over to your dad's house with your grandparents, but what are like some of the things you remember both about your grandparents and your dad and mom and all that stuff?
So I think the biggest thing with my parents is they always did like a joint birthday party for me, and it was always the best day of the year for me. They rented out like an ice skating rink and a bowling alley and a movie theater, and like always did these very large birthday parties, especially because my birthday is only 5 days before Christmas. So they always wanted to make it a really big deal, and just, I mean, it was awesome. All my friends were jealous, and it was so fun. And my friends still talk about those parties. So I think that's where my parents really could come together and love me very well. And they never fought in front of me. Any discussion that they had about me was always done privately, which is just something that I love, especially with my work now where I see parents just fighting in front of kids all the time. Like, that's such a traumatic thing that you can put on your kid. So my parents just did a great job of keeping that separate. And then as far as my grandparents, we just had a like routine. So my grandma had multiple sclerosis, so she was home all the time. And I got my love of cooking from her for sure. We used to just cook all the time, and she was one of the best cooks I think I've ever met. And we would make tuna salad for lunch. And it's something that like is very nostalgic for me now. Like if I make tuna salad, it just reminds me of her, and it just brings a smile to my face. She's just so funny. I get a lot of my personality from her, I think. Pretty sassy, pretty straightforward. Doesn't really take a lot of crap from people. And so you either loved her or you feared her. And so I try to work on making sure people don't fear me, but she was just so caring. But you knew that you did not mess with her. And I loved that about her personality. And then my grandpa, for most of my childhood, he was the mayor of Union, which is the town that they lived in. So he was away all day, working at the city building and stuff like that. So he would always come home and eat dinner with us. And then he would always do like my bedtime routine, which we would sit in this large red leather chair together. And he had a very low voice. It was very gruff. And he would read me just from memory, like childhood stories. So like Goldilocks and the Three Bears, and he would do all the voices. And his voice was just so gruff. So Papa Bear was just like this amazing character for me, and I loved it. And so we'd sit there, and we'd always do that while my grandma like cleaned up from dinner. And then my grandma would put me in bed, and she'd always sing You Are My Sunshine to me and trace my face until I fell asleep. So those are like the best memories I have of them. And it's just them taking care of me.
There were some cracks in Rebecca's vision of her great life with her loving family. One day when she was in third grade, she remembers coming home from her dad's house after a visit.
I came home from a visit with my dad one time, and was just, my mom said I was just tripping along, was just talking, and she's asking me about how the weekend went, stuff like that. And I said, well, and then dad asked me to pee in a cup and he put it on the fridge. And she's like, wait, what are you talking about? And I said, dad made me pee in a cup and then he put it on top of the fridge. And she was like, she just let me go off and do my thing. And she's like, something's wrong. And so she had called a couple people and was like, this isn't right. Like, what's going on? And so then she actually called his employer, which was Warren County Sheriff's Office at the time, and said, I'm suspecting that Michael's using. Has he been testing clean? And she's like, if he has, like, you might just want to watch him the next time he does a drug test. And so I think within the next week, they drug tested him and watched him, and he tested positive. And that's when my mom was just like, nope, we can't. You can't be unsupervised with her at this point. And I will say, like, my mom deserves so many awards for being mom of the year. Like, she protected me through and through. And at that moment, she's like, nope, you can't be unsupervised with her. I will go get full custody. And she got full custody of me within, like, I think the next 6 months.
From then on, Rebecca would have supervised visits with her father. His parents, Rebecca's grandparents, Warren and Madge, would serve as the supervisors. But Michael's troubles didn't end there. Not long after that, he was arrested for stealing from evidence and for running what investigators said was a mobile meth lab from the condo he shared with his first wife. He was found guilty of stealing from evidence, but was acquitted of the drug allegation. He served about 6 months in prison, but not long after he was released, he was rearrested for violating his probation. He spent another 6 months incarcerated.
It was hard because I loved the fact that my dad was a cop, and to see him now completely opposite was really hard for me.
It was so hard on her, in fact, that Rebecca's mom took her to see a counselor, a move that Rebecca now says got her to where she is today. After Michael married his third wife, a woman named Elin, he and Elin moved to Atlanta, where they lived for about 2 years. Michael ended up coming back to live with his parents while he and Elin went through a divorce. Rebecca and her father were still working on their relationship, but it wasn't easy.
But I will say it put a strain on my relationship with my grandparents for sure. Because I didn't want to go over to their house because I knew he would be there. And so things were really tough on us. And I think you could start to see that there was chaos going on in between the house between my grandparents and my dad. And there's just a lot of tension and a lot of snapping at people and stuff like that. So I really didn't see my grandparents a ton the couple months before the murders.
When Rebecca's mom told her the devastating news, she had no idea what to think.
I mean, I just broke down. I started screaming. I could not process the words that she had just told me. And at that point, all we knew was that my dad was in surgery and that we had, like, he was in protective custody, that, like, no one could go to the hospital, like, no one could go see him. And so I was freaking out because I thought someone had just tried to kill my dad and that my grandparents were gone, and didn't really know how to process the grandparents piece. And I think it was just like, okay, is my dad going to make it, or are we going to have three people? And I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about my mom telling me that. It was just very simple, straightforward, and I just lost it. I had to be like helped out of the church, and just really couldn't understand what was going on.
Rebecca and her mom were finally able to go down to the University of Cincinnati Hospital, where her dad was recovering from surgery. She remembered looking down at him in the hospital bed, and seeing blood.
There was blood spatter on his feet. And so like they had not cleaned him up very well, from the scene and stuff like that. So, I just remember like his feet sticking out at the end of the bed, and just being like, oh, like this is perfect. This is awful.
Her mom asked him what happened, and he told her that someone had broken into his parents' house where he had been living. The intruder murdered his parents and then shot him in the leg before fleeing the scene.
So he walked my mom through it, that there was someone who just came in, and mom's like, did you know him? Like, did you know who this was? And he's like, no, but like, I'll find them.
Rebecca told me her mom was skeptical right away and knew something was off.
My mom did not believe the story my dad was giving right off the bat. She said, there's no way. It just seemed too sketchy. And I think she had been in contact with my uncle, who had been in contact with police. And there was already concern that my dad's story was not legit. I think that's when my mom really was like, this is not adding up, and didn't really feel comfortable being down there, just her and myself.
Michael told detectives the same thing. He was questioned while in his hospital bed on June 13th and June 14th, 2009. After telling them his version of events, he reportedly stated, I want an attorney. I'm done. Thank you. After some additional prodding by the detective, he asked him to come back later. As Rebecca and her mom left Michael's hospital room, she remembered seeing some sort of guard, either a police officer or security with the hospital, stationed outside of his room as they left. She said she may have seen him a couple more times in the hospital as he recovered. When he was released, he went to stay in a hotel for a couple days, but then he moved back into his parents' house, to the scene where they had been shot and killed. Rebecca's mom wouldn't allow her to go over there to see him, so one of their meetings took place on the side of the road so he could give her something that had belonged to her grandma. While Rebecca's mom and the rest of her family may have had their suspicions about Michael's story, Rebecca's mind didn't really go there, at least not at first. Instead, she found herself afraid.
I don't know if I really processed it. I think initially I was scared because I thought, if someone's going to come for my grandparents, then how does that mean that they're not going to come for me? And if they just have this vendetta against the Moore family, because I knew my grandparents and I knew that no one would ever want to harm them. So I think I was just scared at first. And then the more things rolled out, the more I just suspected, I don't know if this is actually true. And I think I was just so focused on, you know, we had the initial night of the murders, and then we had to get the funeral underway, and that was down in Nashville, so that required a lot. And then this is also crazy. And then I had to go back to school. So it happened towards the end of summer, or well, I guess the middle of summer. And so things just kind of flew by, and then it was just focusing on getting back to school and being a eighth grader.
About a month after the murders, Rebecca was dealt another blow. Her dad was initially arrested on drug charges, but about a week or two after that, he was charged with the murders.
My mom came home, and I had gotten a text from a friend and said, your dad's on the news again. And I said, what? And so I turned on the news, and my mom came home at that moment. I said, Mom, I got a text saying that dad's on the news. What's going on? And she's like, I'm so sorry. Like, I tried to get home. Like, I wanted to tell you, your dad got arrested today. He's been charged with the murders. And I think I'm a slow processor. So I like to sit back and think about things before I give a response sometimes. Typically I can be like, I can lash out when I'm emotional. And so something that I've really tried to do is just sit back, think about it, and then I'll come to my conclusion. And so I just remember in that moment, just sitting very still on my couch and just being like, I knew this was coming. It doesn't take the pain away any less.
Back at school, Rebecca was going into the eighth grade, and news of her grandparents' murders had hit just about everybody in her small community. She recalled one classmate approaching her and accusing her of lying about what had happened, Your grandparents weren't murdered, he said to her. You're making it all up for attention. Teachers and counselors intervened, and the boy eventually apologized. Rebecca visited her father frequently while he was awaiting trial. Her mom would take her to the jail at 7 a.m. on Saturday mornings.
Sometimes the visits would go great. Sometimes they were just odd, and sometimes I stormed out. So they were just kind of hit or miss.
Rebecca told me that she and her father actually never discussed the murders.
I think we've never had, like, one, all of your jail interviews are recorded. So there's very limited things that the inmates can say, especially when they're pending trial, just because they can use those against them in trial. And so we never really talked about the murders, but he would make comments about, like, oh, like, yeah, like, I really miss your grandma, I really miss your grandpa. And I would just remember being so annoyed of, like, I don't think you get to miss them. Like, I don't think you get to be entitled to that if you actually were the one that killed them.
It would be another 4 years before Michael would stand trial. Prosecutors had announced that they would be seeking the death penalty. Rebecca was on the prosecution's witness list, which meant that she had to be ready to testify. She also had meetings with the defense team. Just prior to trial, a day-long mediation was held where Michael's attorneys were attempting to hash out a plea deal to avoid going to trial. Towards the end of the day, however, Michael requested to speak with his daughter.
The mediator was going back and forth between prosecution and with the defense team, and it had been hours. It was getting late, and so my dad's attorney came out, talked to my mom, and then they both came over to me and said, your dad wants to speak with you. And I was like, oh, God. And so my mom was very hesitant on letting me go in. And I think this was the only time she almost put her foot down. But I said, Mom, like, I'll just go talk to him. Like, it'll be fine. And you got to realize, I had not touched my dad in over 4 years. And now I was going to be in a room with him with his lawyers to where I could, like, physically grab his hand, which was such an odd thing for me.
She went in and gave him a hug. He sat her down and asked her what she thought about going to trial.
And so he's like, what is your thought of going to trial? And I was like, well, if you believe that you did not do this, then you have to make the decision of whether or not you want to go to trial. And I think he really tried to put it on me to make the decision, but I, even at 17, was like, absolutely not. Like, that is not my job. That is not the role I'm going to take in this.
He then dropped a bombshell. He told her that he was now going to tell her what really happened that night.
He was like, okay. And he's like, well, then I need to tell you the truth. And then came up with his new story that he and my grandpa got into a physical fight after my grandpa had killed my grandma. And I just remember breaking down, and his lawyers were pissed. Like, my mom was furious. And I just broke down, and my mom just got me out of that courthouse as fast as she could.
According to Michael's new version of events, Rebecca's grandpa had killed her grandma after an argument. Michael then had no choice but to kill her grandpa after they struggled over the gun. It was yet another story that was unbelievable, perhaps even more unbelievable than the first one. Michael's attorneys, seeing as he was now claiming that he did kill Warren Moore, knew that the plea deal they had been working towards was no longer.
It was that night that it was decided that we would go to trial. Prosecution was done. They were pissed when they found out that story, and they're like, nope, we're done. We will see you at trial. And so things were left on a very bitter note at the end of mediation. My dad's team was furious because it ruined all of their years of work.
Michael's trial started in September of 2013. He was facing two counts of murder and one count each of tampering with physical evidence, possession of a handgun by a convicted felon, and falsely reporting an incident. According to prosecutors, Michael shot and killed both of his parents before shooting himself in the leg to make it look like he wasn't the perpetrator. They told the jury that the stories Michael came up with after the incident are not possible, according to the evidence. As expected, Michael's defense attorneys presented this new version of events to the jury in their opening statements. Joanne Lynch said that Michael was home at his parents' house when he heard them arguing. He then heard a pop, along with the sound of his mother hitting the floor. He ran over and saw his mother's body, so he confronted his father, who was holding a gun. The two men struggled, and the gun went off several times. Two bullets hit Michael in the leg before he was able to grab the gun away, firing it at his dad as he fell. Lynch said Michael came up with the initial intruder story in order to cover up for what the fight was really about: drugs.
No one's ever going to believe that my grandpa just snapped. That's not who my grandpa was in any sense. So I think that's the hardest part, is like, really? Like, you're gonna now throw your dad under the bus? Like, how could you do that? I mean, we're asking the guy that's accused of murder how he could throw someone under the bus, but still, you're just like, how can you do this?
The Commonwealth called several neighbors of the Moores to the stand, who all testified that they had heard the gunshots that night. All of them said it was a quick succession, one right after another. Detective Tim Carnahan testified that as he was at the Moores' house, securing the scene, he thought about it for a second and then guessed that the gun might be on the roof of the house. Sure enough, that's where the .357 revolver was recovered. He said investigators returned to the house the following day and found blood on the back deck near where the gun had been found. The blood was human blood. Gregory Wanger, the medical examiner, told the jury that Warren and Madge Moore were each shot in the back of the head. Warren was shot at close range and also had injuries on his face. The surgeon who operated on Michael after the incident testified that his wounds were superficial. Investigator Brian Cochran took the jury through the items of evidence found at the scene, including more than a dozen bottles of pills. A DNA expert testified that there was a mixture of DNA on the gun from both Michael and Warren, and that the blood on the deck was from Michael and Madge. Michael's older brother, whom the family affectionately refers to as Smitty, took the stand and said he had questions about Michael's intruder story. In the days following the murders, he would ask what had happened, but Michael would offer few details. In the years leading up to the trial, he said he didn't confront Michael, but he did continue to ask questions. He said one thing his brother couldn't answer was how he was able to run down the stairs after he was shot. He said he wouldn't have been able to make it through the narrow stairwell. Smitty said he also asked why someone would come in, shoot Warren and Madge in the head and kill them, but just wound Michael. Michael's response was that it was maybe a warning, but he wouldn't say anything else. Smitty testified that the first time he had heard Michael's new version of what happened was just days before the trial. On cross-examination, Smitty admitted that their father, Warren, was on several medications and that he had a number of health problems. He had also seen a psychiatrist and was dealing with his wife's multiple sclerosis diagnosis. Michael's current girlfriend, Sherry, testified that while he was in the hospital, he told her too that an intruder had broken in. One of the last pieces of evidence the Commonwealth presented to the jury were the results of gunshot residue tests conducted on Warren Moore. The results were inconclusive. The year 2020 shows up a lot in science fiction. A lot of people predicted that by now we'd be teleporting to work, riding around in flying cars, or even living on Mars. Those predictions were obviously way off. And the truth is, we'll always get the future wrong, which is why we need to get life insurance right. And that's where Policy Genius can help. Policy Genius makes finding the right life insurance a breeze. In just minutes, you can compare quotes from the top insurers to find your best price. And you could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. Once you apply, the Policy Genius team will handle all of the paperwork and red tape, so you don't have to. They can also help you find the right home and auto insurance or disability insurance too. So if your science fiction dreams for 2020 still haven't become science fact, don't get discouraged. Get life insurance. It takes just a few minutes to find your best price and apply at policygenius.com. Policy Genius. We'll always get the future wrong. Better get life insurance right. The RealReal is the leading reseller for authenticated luxury consignment. Sell your men's and women's luxury fashion, fine jewelry, watches, art and home, and earn more. The RealReal makes it easy to sell your items with three options. First, experience their free white glove in-home consignment consultation and pickup by one of their luxury managers. Or come visit one of their brick and mortar locations for in-store drop-off, where you can meet the expert in person and go through the authentication process one-on-one. And finally, for those of you who want to contribute to the circular economy through consignment, but don't have enough time in the day, they will send you everything you need for a free, safe, and sustainable shipping process. So think sustainably, consign with The RealReal today, and earn up to 85% commission plus site credit. Authentic, sustainable luxury, only at TheRealReal.com. When it was the defense's turn to present their case, one of the first responders to the scene testified that Michael's testicle was dangling when he arrived, even though the surgeon had earlier said it was a superficial wound. Then Marty Pyburn, a longtime friend of Madge Moore, testified that she talked to Madge on the phone just hours before she died. She said she didn't notice anything wrong that night, but that she had noticed a change in both Madge and Warren's attitudes over the last few years. She told the court that Warren was depressed and was angry with Michael. He had given him money and a place to live, and Michael abused it by taking pills. She said Madge was feeling like she was a prisoner because she was always confined to the house due to her multiple sclerosis, and that Warren was often frustrated with her because of it. She testified that when Michael got out of the hospital, she was the one who picked him up. He stayed with her for 2 nights, and she said she would have allowed him to stay longer because she was not afraid of him. Another friend of Madge's, Judy Christman, testified that one time after she had surgery, Madge came over with some prescription pills because the doctor hadn't prescribed her any. She, too, said that Warren was depressed and that she and Madge had started drifting apart. She said at one point she had thought of the Moore family as a perfect family, but as the years went by, she saw that it wasn't. Much to Rebecca's surprise, Michael decided to testify, too. By this time, Rebecca was heading into her senior year of high school. She attended the trial as often as she could, but she did go into school on some days. That's where she was when she got word that her father was going to take the stand.
My dad was not supposed to take the stand. That was never in the cards. Everyone knew that it would not be great if he did. And so I was sitting at school. I forget what I was doing, but I was on the news because I just had downloaded the news apps to make sure I was staying updated. And a reporter had tweeted Michael Moore set to take the stand in an hour and a half. And I was like, oh my God. So I called my mom. I said, Mom, I'm going to the trial. She's like, Rebecca, I can't go to work. Like, she's like, I can't leave work. Like, you can't go. And I said, Mom, I'm going. Like, there's no other option. Like, I have to go. And so she called my aunt, who was already at the trial. And she said that she'd keep an eye on me because they didn't want this, like, hormonal 17-year-old just running through the Boone County Courthouse.
Michael first talked about his childhood and about his very tight family. He said that when he was in high school, other kids would come to live with them because his parents would take them in. He called them great people. He said he started to party while in high school and that he and his mother had a rocky relationship. She saw more potential in him, he said. When asked if he had lived up to that potential, he said, no, I have not. Michael called his father brilliant and said he never failed at anything. Even when he was diagnosed with colon cancer and had a difficult prognosis, Warren still bounced back. Michael testified that he got married, had a child, and became a Warren County Sheriff's deputy. In March 2002, he injured his back while on the job and later became addicted to painkillers. He told the jury that his mom, who had pills for her MS diagnosis, would often share her pills with him. She had given him the combination to the safe where she kept them because she couldn't always open it herself. The fact that Madge would share her pills with Michael upset Warren, Michael said. They would argue often about it, and Warren would try and limit her pills. Michael told the jury that he's an addict, that he couldn't stop, and that his mom would give her pills to him because he said she's loving. Sometime in 2005, he testified that he opened the safe and saw a note in there from his dad. The note read, quote, "Michael, if even a single pill is missing from the safe, don't ever come back. You'll never be welcome again." On the day of the murders, Michael said he and his dad were on the internet looking up directions when he asked his dad to get his mom another pill. Warren asked what happened to the one she had, and Michael told him that she had given it to him. Warren refused to give her another one. Michael said he told his mother what his father had said and that she became angry. Warren came up the stairs then and they started arguing. Then it got quiet, he said. He said he heard a pop and then heard his mom hit the floor. He ran upstairs and saw his mom lying there. He said he was angry, and so he went to find his father, who was on the stairway. They struggled. The gun went off and hit him in the thigh. He said he thought he was going to die, and so he wrestled the gun away and fired. He then fired a second time. Michael said he was thinking, "What just happened? Oh my God, I just shot my dad. My dad just killed my mom. I'm shot." He said his immediate reaction was to try and cover it up because he was scared. The jury, however, didn't believe Michael's story, either one of them. They found him guilty on all counts.
Yeah, the guilty verdict was just, it was a rough night. But I think also, like, coming back to the community I grew up in, when I got home, one of my best friends, so my grandparents died when I was in eighth grade. His dad died when we were in the ninth grade. And so we experienced very serious losses very close together. And so he had left a bouquet of flowers on my front deck. And I just remember just like getting them and just being so excited. And we love musicals. And he like wrote in the card something to one of our favorite musicals. And I just remember being like, this is my breath of fresh air during this like horrible day of I still have people that love me and that are willing to help protect me, basically. And it came in the form of my 17-year-old friend that I'd known my whole life.
Rebecca was asked by Michael's defense team to speak on his behalf at his sentencing. The importance of what they were asking her to do wasn't lost on her, and it made her feel like her family was divided.
The trial was really hard for me because I saw, you visibly saw that our family was split. And that was really hard, that there's certain things that we will never recover from, and this is going to be one of them. You know, and my mom got called to testify by prosecution. So even in my own household, it was like, well, I'm the only one on his side. And that was really, really hard.
So you felt like you were on his side and your mom was on the prosecution side. Is that kind of how you looked at it?
Yeah, because so I think, and not as bluntly as I'm about to say it, but it was very like well known that my role was to get him off death penalty. And I felt so much pressure. I mean, I'm 17. I'm trying to just get through my senior year of high school. I was still trying to decide where I wanted to go to college. Like, but I have to just take this break and go attend this trial with all these emotions and all these feelings and just not knowing what the hell is going on. And so I don't know, there was just so much pressure on me at that time. And I just felt so overwhelmed, especially because it was like, well, we need you to testify because your dad is really looking at a really good chance of getting convicted and getting the death penalty.
So at his sentencing, Rebecca did it. She went up there and argued against something that she had been for prior to being put into this situation, the death penalty.
I was always like, oh yeah, like if people are convicted of a heinous crime, like they should be given the death penalty, whatever. And I say, now that I look back, it's like, ooh, you should probably like experience it before you really like make that comment. Because for me, like, I know that my dad could be a dad from prison, even if he was going to be gone forever. And so when I testified, I said, you know, I fully believe that my dad can still act as a parent, even if he's hours away in Kentucky. I believe that he still has a role in my life. And I also believe that this is going to be a time where we can really grow and work on our relationship. And I made the point that my dad being in jail for those past 4.5 years were the first time that I've had a dad that's not on drugs. And that was just such a unique experience for me and something that I think just really changed my outlook on having him in my life. I think it's really easy to just shut someone down and keep them away. And I'm all about healthy boundaries. Like there are certain things that my dad cannot be a part of in my life. And that's just in order to protect myself and make sure that I'm not dependent on him and that I'm not just always willing to bend over backwards for him. But there's just certain areas where, no, like we can work on this. We can try and establish a healthy relationship. And I always felt that my dad could have a role in my life, but I just wasn't certain of what that role was going to be at that time.
Michael was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. His appeals have since been denied. I asked Rebecca how often she sees her father while he's in prison. She told me that there was an incident at the jail not too long ago, a fight that he was involved in, and so his visits are currently suspended and will be until at least the next year. They talk on the phone, however, about every 3 weeks. She said their best conversations are about her work and the work he used to do as a police officer. She still has her memories of her dad being a great dad, and in her small community, she still runs into and even works with people who used to work with her dad. Rebecca wonders a lot about what could have become of them if her father had not had an addiction and had not made the choices he made.
The best thing that I've ever done for my relationship with my dad, my degree is in social services, but it's a focus on addictions counseling. And I really wanted to understand addictions because I want to understand why my dad's brain works the way it does. And the more that I understand about addicts in general, the more I'm able to understand my dad and just have a more working relationship with him.
I asked Rebecca what advice she would give to someone listening to this who may be in a similar situation. I watch a lot of trials, and I know my listeners do too. Every witness, every victim, every defendant has a family or has loved ones who may be struggling behind the scenes with how to cope with these decisions that they didn't make. She told me that for her, there were two main things that helped her: her faith and her counselor. She also feels lucky that she had so much support from her community.
The love and the care that came from just my community really pulled me through, you know, my friends and my teachers. And I'm just really thankful for those people because, I don't know, it's fun now that I work for the county. I get to interact with them pretty frequently still, especially with teachers, just because they're our main reporters of child abuse. And so it's cool to see them still loving and taking care of students years later, because I just really felt that from them.
Despite it all, Rebecca still struggles with how she views her father.
There's my dad, who's my dad and who I'm always going to love and try to take care of. And then there's my dad, who's been convicted of these horrible and horrific things. And then there's the guy that I associate with killing my grandparents, who I loved more than anyone in the world. And so it's really hard because I feel like you have to kind of put into categories, because if you mix it all, you're just going to be a train wreck. And so, like, I view my dad in very different ways and different scenarios, but I've never been afraid of him. But I'm also
I think out of something that I've gotten out of all of this is I'm pretty resilient and I'm not going to put up with his crap a lot, which took me a really long time to understand because I do think one of my dad's faults is he's very manipulative. And especially when I was younger, I believed every word he said. I thought he was greater than anything that this world could offer. He was my hero and someone that I looked up to a ton. So I always wanted to see the good in him. And it took me a really long time to realize I have to make some of my own decisions and can't let him rule my life with certain aspects, which has then created a tension in our relationship now. But I think now we have a more constructive relationship than we've ever had.
As we talked, Rebecca remarked that she has photos up in her office at work of her friends, family, and even of her father.
I mean, I'm sitting at my desk right now at work and I'm looking at 40 pictures that I have hung up of my friends, my family, and, you know, that includes my dad. I have a picture of my dad and I when I was a baby, and then I have a picture of him in his jumpsuit from prison. So, you know, I'm laughing because they're just two very different pictures, but they're important moments in my life and things that I don't take for granted. And I don't know, I'm smiling because I like love all of these people and they have all been there for me through thick and thin. And I'm just so thankful for the people that are around me.
And that's all for this episode. I want to thank Rebecca Moore for sharing her story with me. Many people don't know this, but Court Junkie used to be a blog I started back in 2013. On that blog, I would accept writer submissions. And one day, a writer reached out to me with a story about the murders of Warren and Madge Moore, and so I posted it. Fast forward to October 2019, and I received an email from Rebecca Moore saying she had Googled her family's name and came across that blog post. She had started listening to the podcast, and we started conversing back and forth, and then decided to create an episode about the murders of her grandparents. I want to thank Rebecca for her bravery and willingness to talk about it and share her story with all of us. If you have any thoughts on this case, please join our discussion on Instagram at Court Junkie, tweet me at Court Junkie Pod, or email me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. If you want to hear these episodes ad-free, please consider supporting the podcast on Patreon. Go to courtjunkie.com/support for more details on that and on how to get access to additional bonus episodes. And if you have a story you'd like to share with me that involves our criminal justice system, I'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening. Until next time. As the NFL season wraps up, you're going to want to check out the Dan Patrick Show for everything coming up. Dan and the Danettes provide the most up-to-date sports coverage every day of the week. Plus, Dan's got the biggest guests, the best commentary, and everything in between with a bit of fun on the side. Be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Podcast One, Apple Podcasts, and many other podcast apps so you can get new episodes every day.